Welcome to Catholic Morality and the Catechism. Monsignor William Smith talks about things our society would sometimes rather not discuss. Moral conscience, virtues, and the Ten Commandments. Here's Monsignor Smith.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Bill Smith. I teach moral theology at Dunwoody, which is the seminary in the Archdiocese of New York. We're considering the moral teaching of the Catholic Church, especially as it is presented in this summary but wonderful fashion in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Throughout, I'll be referring to my own little version here, which is actually the Catechism, but it's only the third part, and it's easier when it's flat out here. This time we want to take a look at one or two of the fundamental concepts, and the first one is about our purpose in life. It sounds philosophical, it sounds a little bit remote, but it is absolutely, absolutely crucial and important. It answers the question like, where are we going? Why are we here? And when we say, and we begin part three, if we refer to the numbers, in 1691 of the Catechism, it starts with a beautiful quote from Pope St. Leo the Great, and it tells Christians, recognize your dignity. Your dignity. And the dignity of every Christian, the dignity of every human, is that they are made in the image and likeness of God. And that's really the moral challenge, to improve that image of God, to enhance or increase the likeness of God in us. That's the moral call, and that's the moral challenge. Because God is truly our end, in the sense of the purpose of our life. And what the Catechism does in this first section, very fundamental question, says it's going to involve us in a catechesis of the Holy Spirit, in a catechesis of grace, a catechesis of beatitudes, and also of human virtues and Christian virtues. And the beatitudes are also important, which we look at next. But the first and the final point of all of the moral teaching involves a person. Not a principle, not an abstraction, but the person of Jesus Christ. That is our purpose in life, to live in union with Christ in this life so that we can live in union with God forever in the next. That Jesus is the way and the life and the truth. And that's what they put there in 1698. They put it right up front with a number of pertinent citations from so many of the saints who have lived that, because they, better than anyone else, have shown us the image and likeness of God, that image in them is so clear when we see it, and the likeness is so clear when we see it. And that's what every baptized Christian is called to do, to improve that image, to enhance that likeness, and coming closer to God. Because of that notion of being made in the image of God, a notion very popular with the fathers of the Church, so it goes way back in Catholic tradition. And, of course, it is rooted in the Bible. It's in the first book of everybody's Bible. It says about the human person that God made him and her in his own image and in his own likeness. That's never said about anything else. All of God's creation is good. No question about it. Everything God made is good. But only one thing in all of God's good creation is made in his own image and his own likeness, and that's human beings. Human persons. And that makes a link, that makes a connection, a closeness, and opens possibilities that are simply not open to any other part of God's creation. So this rich traditional notion of the image of God is put right at the beginning of the moral section of the Catechism, because it'll involve both some amount of reason, which is why we are in the image of God, and we also have the capability of using our free will, namely to cooperate, to answer that call of Almighty God, to improve that image, to enhance that likeness. We are the only ones who are not just pushed by human nature, but by free cooperation, we can either come closer or turn from God, in whose image and likeness we are made. And that's not available to any other creature, only to human persons. And that'll become important for morality. We see the way the Catechism is structured, takes the question on human dignity, takes the question on the image and likeness. Then each little section or subsection is followed by, they call it in English, in brief, a little summary of short little parts that highlight the passage that went before. And those, I think, for very young people, would be a very good way to begin reading the Catechism, because they could easily memorize those and remember them. But the section that begins in 1716 through 1729 talks about our vocation to beatitude, beatitude being happiness or fulfillment. And they take the traditional teaching of the Church and ask, well, really, what makes someone happy? And they give the best example is in the Beatitudes. And the Beatitudes, which some people, of course, they are there in St. Matthew's Gospel in the fifth chapter. They begin the Sermon on the Mount in St. Matthew's Gospel. But some people think that they're out of reach, that they're kind of unrealistic. And the Holy Father, not here, but in his encyclical Veritatis Splendor, calls the Beatitudes the Magna Carta of Christian morality, which is a beautiful expression. The Magna Carta, the master charter, the master outline, the master plan of Christian living. And it is the Master's plan, because it is, after all, his sermon. It's the Lord's Sermon on the Mount. And that's the goal. Now, we do have this desire for happiness, to live in a happy fashion, to seek what is good. And they take the traditional or the classic examples from St. Augustine, who goes through many things, because there are many ways to describe, as the Catechism clearly teaches. We can talk about Christian fullness, Christian beatitude, as the coming of the kingdom of God. We are told that the pure of heart will see God. We are called about entering the joy of the Lord, or in the end being peace, at peace with God, enjoying God's rest. But there is as well a beautiful little sentence of St. Augustine where he has the expression, there, now he's talking about the end of life, the purpose of life, there we shall rest and we shall see. We shall see and we shall love. We shall love and we shall praise. We will behold in the end without end. And that's what we mean when we talk about purpose in life or end of life, that in the end, this end will not end. Now, some might say, isn't it a little bit strange talking about the end here at the beginning? Now, this makes good philosophical sense. Why so? If you're taking a journey by whatever means, by a ship, by a plane, you must know where you are going. Otherwise, activity is aimless. In theology, we call this eschatology. Eschaton is a Greek word meaning end. And the eschatology is that part of theology that considers the end things or the final things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And, of course, it's kind of backwards Catholicism, but we always put what's last first so that we know where we're going. And that's the truth of the matter. In the end, there will be four things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. Death, the end of human life. This is a big question, and this is why it's put first. Remember, people will say, well, it's not like the old catechism, because the old catechism answered this question very early. Who made us? God made us. Second question in the old catechism, why did God make us? To know, love, and serve him in this world so as to be happy with him in the next. Well, that's not it. It is in the new catechism. If you look there in 1721, it says, I read you, God put us in this world to know, love, and serve him, and so come to paradise with him. To know, love, and serve him, and come to paradise with him. Let's pause here for a second. Why is this important? This is important because it opens up our moral horizon. A lot of our contemporary Americans figure, well, look, you live 45 years, 65 years, 85 years, then you die. What happens? A lot of people don't want to answer that question. A lot of people feel that they don't know the answer to that question. A lot of people don't even want to discuss the possibility, so that they don't even like to use the word death. They'll say, Grandma went on to the great choir in the sky, if she were a singer, or Grandpa went to the great roundup in the sky, if perhaps he was a horseback rider. They'll use all sorts of circumlocutions rather than saying somebody died. Because when you ask the question about death, what happens after death? For many contemporaries, probably all secular humanists, nothing happens after death. Now here, Christianity has a very important and explicit teaching. We repeat it every Sunday when we repeat the creed together at Mass. We believe in the resurrection of the body and the life of the world to come. Solid Christian doctrine. That means that every individual Christian is going to live forever. Live in this life for a while, but in the next life forever. And that opens our moral horizon to the infinite, to forever. And that makes an important dimension. If, in fact, you're only going to live 45 years, 65, 85 years, that's all she wrote. There's no second chapter in this book of life. There's no second act in this play called life. There's no second stage in this rocket called life. Then that's it. You have a flat horizontal outlook, and inevitably that commits you to a moral theory, basically of utilitarianism or efficiency. If there is no next life, the answer's got to be, well, you better eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you're going to die, and then nothing happens. But Christianity doesn't teach that. Christianity says that our life now is really only the first chapter of at least a two-chapter book, that it is the first stage of at least a two-stage rocket, that it is the first act of a play that has many acts, and the purpose of it all is eventually union with God. So the secular humanist outlook on morality closes, has a truncated, has a dumbed down horizon. It's this life only, and what you can measure. Whereas right at the beginning, in the Christian Catholic outlook, it opens up unto eternity and unto eternal life with God. Union with Christ in this life, union with God forever. I know that might sound philosophical, but something as important as this is probably what's buried behind many arguments in our society about the gift and worth of human life, on questions about abortion and euthanasia. It might not sound that, but it's buried in there. After all, why is human life, why do we say that it's sacred? Well, someone could say, well, I hear that terminology in church, which is quite true. But really, why is human life sacred? Because basically, it is a gift from God that we have on trust for a while, and eventually we go back to God. If someone doesn't believe that, if someone thinks human life is nothing different, say, from a thing like a Bic pen, well, when a Bic pen writes well, fine. When it starts to get spotty, when it starts to get unclear, you get rid of it the way you get rid of anything that no longer works, because we judge things by their usefulness. But if, in fact, human life is not a thing, but actually a gift from God that's going to last forever, when the Holy Father visited the United States, that famous sermon he gave on the Capitol Mall, the Pope said in one sentence what I've been struggling for over the last 10 minutes, the Holy Father said, when God gives a gift, it is forever. It is forever. And human life is a gift forever. In union with Christ in this life, so as to be in union with God forever in heaven. And that opens our moral horizon. I grant you, it's not a subject that all that many people think about right away, but it is absolutely determinative of our whole moral outlook. Whether our moral outlook is wedded and welded merely to this world only, what you see is what you get. There's nothing more. There's nothing extra. If you believe that, that's how you will guide and operate your life and your moral choices as well. But if, in fact, Christianity is true, and what Christianity truly teaches is true, that our life here is probative and preliminary to our union with God and life in God forever, that opens up a whole different horizon. So when they say this vocation to beatitude, to the fullness, the full happiness, it's not just in this life, but it is also the life with God forever. And so many of the saints, we started with St. Leo the Great, particularly the beautiful expressions here, in the Catechism from St. Augustine, also from St. Irenaeus. Again, one of the indexes in the Catechism just lists all those marvelous sayings, because whoever did the final editing, they really went and they culled the best, they gleaned the best of Catholic tradition to make the points that are traditionally made. And it is to know, love, and serve God in this world so as to be happy with Him in the next. That is our purpose. And our purpose in life is open to the transcendent. It's open to the infinite. Therefore, if we're talking about that fullness of life, if we're talking about that kind of beatitude, this presents us and confronts us with decisions. Decisions which we call moral choices. In 1723, they talk as well about certain goods where our happiness will not be found. And it may not be found in riches, it may not be found in human fame. They cite Cardinal Newman talking about wealth is an idol that some people make the center of their life. He says notoriety is another idol. In fact, what Cardinal Newman called newspaper fame, making a name for yourself and having that notoriety. You know as well as I do, those things only last a while, sometimes only a headline, and they're not so important anymore. But the fullness of it is something that we have to make choices about. And that's why we are instructed in the Catechism to take into consideration the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, and the teaching of the Apostles, and go by it step by step. But if it confronts us with choices, it leads us to the third article, which is another fundamental thing, which has to do with human freedom. So first, our purpose in life, the real purpose. You have to know what port you're aiming for, otherwise no wind is a good wind. And if our purpose is to live in union with Christ in this life so that we can live with God forever in the next, then that's the goal and the final end. That's the end, as St. Augustine says, that has no end. That will involve us making choices. Therefore, the question of human freedom comes up, and it's treated kind of briefly here, starting in 1731. Obviously, this is important. Why? Because if there is no freedom, there is no morality. If there is no freedom, there is no responsibility. If you think it through, when we use words like responsibility, imputability, credit, or blame, all of those terms presuppose that free will exists. We don't talk about the responsibility of canaries or the responsibility of dolphins, because canaries and dolphins, nice little things, but they don't really have free will. They can only act on their own instincts, on their own nature. Remember, the human person is the only one in God's good creation made in the image and likeness of God. And one of the things about that image and likeness is just as God has free will and intelligence, so do we. Much less, of course, obviously, but we have intelligence and free will, and it's the use of those. We are told here in this beautiful passage from the book of Sirach, God willed that man should be left in the hand of his own counsel. God willed that man should be left in the hand of his own counsel. This gorgeous ability that we have called freedom. But freedom can be well used or it can be misused. And some people, I think, when they get frustrated, they say, well, God should have made it so everything turns out right. Well, then we would have been robots. We would have been machines. God has more respect for human freedom, I think, than we do. And it's true, as St. Augustine points out, that God brought us into existence without our asking for it, without our cooperation. But we will not ever be brought into His presence without our cooperation, without our willing it. And there is the question of human freedom, both reason and will. It's the combination of those two things that make up what we call in morality a human act. That may sound like a simple term, but it's a technical term in moral theology. What do we mean by a human act? A human act is one that proceeds from the will with a knowledge of the end. Notice two components. Proceeds from the will, so there's a volitional component, with a knowledge of the end. So there's a cognitive component, that intelligence and will, which is special to the human person. That's really what we mean by a human act. These are the things that we are responsible for. If, for instance, someone was forced to do something against their will, we don't hold them responsible for that. If it was completely lacking in knowledge, they didn't know what they were doing, we don't call that a moral act either. It's only those actions which proceed from the will with a knowledge of the end. These are what we call human actions. These are the only things that we predicate good and evil of, right and wrong. Right and wrong would be the standard. This is a famous theme of Pope John Paul II, who in his encyclical on moral theology, Veritatis Splendor, 1993, the largest part of that encyclical, the whole second part, most of the second part, from numbers 35 all the way up to 53, talks about the connection between freedom and law and freedom and truth. And the Pope makes a very important notion and a contribution there, because obviously our human journey would not really be personally our own unless it's a free journey, a free journey. But he keeps highlighting the connection between freedom and truth, freedom and truth. Freedom is a wonderful thing. Freedom is what we're told. God made man and left him in the hand of his own counsel, his own good use of freedom. But freedom, as such, can be an unguided missile. If it's not rooted in the truth and geared to the good, it could become quite destructive. There are destructive uses of freedom. And it is like an unguided missile. And the trouble with unguided missiles is nobody knows where they're going to land. They could also land on your head, which wouldn't be comfortable. But if we go back then, a human act, truly a moral act, that proceeds from the will with the knowledge of the end, that's what we call a voluntary action. And that's what we start to talk about responsibility, which becomes very important in moral theology. Now, we know that there are obstacles to human freedom. Sometimes ignorance, inadvertence, force, fear, habit, and things like that. And each one of those factors has to be considered in the assessment of both doing well or doing wrongly. But we want to be careful that we don't overdose and eliminate. I mean, there are schools of philosophy that simply say free will is an illusion. B.F. Skinner thought that way. And sometimes we're in such a hurry to explain away moral evil that we forget, if you do away with freedom, the shoe of responsibility fits both feet. If we're not free to do anything wrong, then we're really not free to do anything right. We might be interested in removing blame, but we're usually not interested in removing credit. But it fits the human person, and it fits both feet. And it's a very important thing. Perhaps a little bit less than some philosophers talk, because certain factors do come into play, but certainly more than some strict psychologists would allow, because some people think that the human person's kind of a bundle of, I don't know, cause and effect things, that if we knew enough about cause and effect, you could explain everything. Not true. You would end up explaining away the key to being human. And what's truly important here is basically we argue for something that's relatively simple. Look, that there are some normal people who, under most normal circumstances, are normally responsible for what they do. Namely, the good things they do, they should get credit for. The wrong things they do are blameworthy. That's what we mean by human responsibility. When we say that someone is responsible, we mean that that action is theirs. It proceeded from their will with a knowledge of their end. They knew what they were doing, and they willed to do it, for good or for ill. That's their doing. That's their acting. The nutritionists, the people who are warning us about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol and everything else, they have a little saying that you are what you eat. In morality, you are what you choose. You are what you choose. You are the sum total of your free choices in life. Namely, what proceeds from your will with the knowledge of the end, what you make the direct object of your will, and you directly will to do something, that action is your action, for good or for ill. If it's for good, it is credit worthy. If it's for ill, it is blame worthy. And that notion of human freedom is obviously important in what we call the economy of salvation. You cannot read the Bible, even in a hurry, without coming to the conclusion that basically God makes an offer, God makes an invitation, and it's up to us freely and responsibly to respond to that invitation. He may have created us without involving our will, but he will not save us without the involvement of our will. So that knowing component and that willing component, that's the heart and lung machine of what we call a human act, a human act. Now, there are some acts of a human being, like breathing, like sleeping, and some other things that really don't require all that much. Those are kind of automatic functions. Like your digestion. You can say someone has good digestion or bad digestion, but that's not making a moral statement. They're automatic. They just happen. They don't really involve something that proceeds from your will with the knowledge of the end. But if it's telling the truth or telling a lie, if it's respecting justice or stealing, taking something against the reasonable will of the owner, if it's respecting human life or enhancing it by support, generosity, and service, or killing them, that is something that proceeds from the will and the knowledge of the end. And that is what most concerns morality. So our purpose in life and the notion of human freedom, put them together so that the whole understanding is union with Christ in this life, so as we be in union with God forever in the next.
Join us again next time for Catholic Morality and the Catechism on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.